Tim Goldstein, autistic adult, and your host for Life in a Neurotypical Universe, where we take a look at life from the perspective of an autistic adult. In this episode of Life in the Neurotypical Universe, we have a very special feature for you. I was in a panel discussion along with Carrie Kelly of Atypical Workplace, who's another noted authority in the autism spectrum space and has Asperger's herself. During this panel discussion, you'll hear Carrie and I discuss back and forth on different topics. We've also got some audience participation and tried to include those best we could, even though we weren't really set up with mics out in the audience. I think you're going to enjoy this. It's a great discussion and great things to learn. And thank you very much to Looker in Santa Cruz for hosting this event and allowing us to be there and participate and share with all the Looker employees. Carrie, you have to be nice to Patricia.
Oh, because she's in your group.
No, she's my boss. There you go, Patricia. You learned something about neurodiversity already. We'll just say anything just because it's true.
And we decide what truth is. Just in case you're wondering how.
Right. If it doesn't fit your truth, that's okay. We're okay with it, but it does fit ours.
Because truth is contextual.
Great. I just learn stuff every day.
Wonderful. So thank you guys for joining us. We are going to have an action-packed afternoon where we're going to start with just introducing ourselves and our stories, really showcasing Tim because he's such an incredible resource for all of the Looker folks, and then dive into the questions that we had you guys give us, pointing us towards your areas of interest. We heard a lot of understanding what is neurodiversity and how do you relate to the neurodiverse folks, and communication, what are some best practices there, and then collaborating. How do you bring out the best in your neurodiverse talent? And even as somebody, some folks who answer the questions are themselves neurodiverse. So it's like, how can I tap into my own awesomeness and help showcase it for the world? So we're going to dive into those four areas. And again, starting off with some introductions of our story. Does that sound good to you guys? Woo! New York friends, are you able to talk to us, or are you just listening?
They can turn around.
Oh, hey!
I guess we have to wave. We have to wave that way, but look this
that
way.
Right? That's funny. Cool. So I'd love to start it off with Tim sharing your story, and through your story explaining what neurodiversity is by virtue of your path towards it.
Well, I'm Tim Goldstein, and I work in professional services as a senior consultant. I'm neurodiverse. I have Asperger's, which is not the only thing that makes you neurodiverse. There's neurodiversity in all reality is just saying you're human. Now, there's all different types of humans. And we're just saying in neurodiversity, we're looking at it as a particular type of being human. And I guess the way I would explain it is, as I've gone through my career, I've had, we'll say, great successes and lots of firings. Okay, you're not listening, Patricia, right now.
Take off your boss hat. I'm just kidding.
And it almost always involves a miscommunication or a misunderstanding of who I am, what I'm saying, what I'm trying to accomplish versus what the person, the other side is thinking that I'm trying to accomplish. Here at Looker has been actually a very, very interesting experience. On one hand, Looker is phenomenally good in diversity in general. I think everybody's responded quite well to the things Cornell's been trying to help us with. On the other hand, I happen to work in a particular group that is probably the most non-neurodiverse group maybe in the whole company. Maybe not, but probably close. And the reason is because the process we go through to hire people has a tendency to accentuate neurotypical kind of behaviors. Communication, the ability to sense, the emotion, the be able to follow and, switch up as you need. Lots of those things are emphasized, which makes sense because we're in a very public-facing role. I mean, we deal with clients hours and hours on end. That makes sense. The fact that I actually made it into the group is probably a little bit unique. I don't think we really have anybody else neurodiverse in that group.
Can I jump in and ask you
a
question?
Oh, sure.
Can you share a little bit of your background when it comes to finding roles that meet your not only your area of expertise, but also invite your eccentricities for so you could show up and be yourself? What's been your history leading up to this role at Looker? Because there's some components to your story that I think they might enjoy, but how you came to find out you were neurodiverse and then ended up at such an incredible place like Looker that embraces the real you.
That's a really interesting story. This is probably my fourth career that I'm on now, which is part of a story that tends to be fairly true of people who are neurodiverse. Just like you had mentioned, you're on the three or four for you now.
Oh, yes, too many to count.
Exactly. I started out, like many people who are neurodiverse, we tend to go into areas that are our interests. And when I was a older teenager, my interest was bicycles. I'm old enough that was during the 70s, it was the bike boom, and I was into bikes. Well, believe it or not, I decided to go out and have a 16-year career in the bicycle world because I like bicycles so much. And went all the way through, became national sales manager, put together international supply teams, done all those kind of things in the bike industry. So it wasn't just wrenching, that's where I started from, but where I left was, you know, at the top of the industry. Along that one, I did get fired for my first time ever. And I had been with a company for 6 years. No notice, no nothing, just the owners flew in and said, we're making a change, you're not working here anymore.
So no feedback.
No feedback, no input, no warning, no nothing, no, you know, you're out of line, you need to fix something, just bam, you're gone. Now, I will say that I do feel vindicated because about 3 years later, I got a fax from the guy who fired me that says, we're looking to make another change, would you come back?
That's funny. What was your second career? When that didn't work, how'd you pivot?
When I pivoted from that one, I actually stayed in the bicycle business, but I became an independent rep in the bicycle business.
Wow, so you're autistic, but you found success in a very heavily customer-facing role.
Because I was dealing with things that I loved.
Okay, tell them a little bit, because with the folks who said, what is neurodiversity, want to share a little bit about when it comes to the autism component of it. How does that play into facets of autism?
One of the things, of course, that everybody has to remember when you're dealing with autism or whether you're dealing with neurodiverse in general is there is not one, you know, exemplar that you can hold up and say this represents them. Just like you can't take any single neurotypical person. And we'll kind of define those terms, but neurotypical means just a normal, basic, regular old person. There's no exemplar. We can't pick any one person in all of Looker that's, you know, the model for all typical people, just like you can't pick, you know, Carrie or I as being the exemplars for people who are neurodiverse. She and I both tend to have much better outward presentation and, you know, interaction skills than tend to be normal amongst the neurodiverse crowd. It's far more common to have more challenges interacting and speaking, particularly larger groups and things like this. And, you know, the fact that you have two autistic people sitting in front of you having chats with you perfectly comfortable is a little bit strange.
And that's why I think it's interesting that you first started. So folks on the spectrum, we do have this tendency to just find an area of interest and go for it. Hans Asperger's in the 30s, he was a pediatrician in Austria. He called us his little scientists, because we would just geek out on our areas of interest. So that's neat. So that's how you just went for it. Your passion turned people onto bikes, but then you started hitting ceilings. And I'm curious, in your journey, when did you go to a doctor? Because it sounds like your first bike, second career, you still were in bikes. Which point
third career was starting it into IT.
Okay, IT space.
And then while I also was doing my IT career, I opened a manufacturing company that I developed all the products. Ran it for 10 years. I mean, I'd run that at night while the employees ran it during the day, and I'd do my IT work during the day. So I had simultaneously two careers.
Before the machine manufacturing plant, my wife and I had a jewelry, tool, and supply store.
What haven't you done?
There's plenty of things.
Holy pivot, that is.
What ended up happening is after that cumulatively, that's about 13 years that I had two simultaneous careers. And about year 12 or so, I noticed things weren't quite working as well as they used to be working. And my wife basically gave me the ultimatum of, you need to go do something or else, which tends to get your attention pretty quick. And I did. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor put me on first antidepressants. And then I figured, well, if my general doctor could put me on antidepressants that actually helped me function a little bit better, maybe I should go actually see a specialist and go to a psychiatrist instead of just a GP. So I went to the psychiatrist, and this was at that point 5 years ago. So I was very late diagnosed. I knew I was different. I knew I interacted, differently with people. I knew I thought differently than a lot of people did, but I had no clue why. I just was different. I mean, I grew up on a farm. I didn't really hang out with the people I went to school with because they were in a totally different district I was bused into. So I never, just never figured out. I had, three brothers, no sisters. We'd go do the normal boy thing, beat the crap out of each other, and, life goes on. And so it never turned up there either. And it wasn't until, five years ago that I was actually diagnosed. And to me, it was very liberating because I'd understood that I was different. I mean, I knew that. But I never had any clue why, and why is it that I could do so well and become so successful in an area but then get fired? That just didn't, normally you get fired before you become successful. It just doesn't really work the other way around. But what I learned eventually...
And that's what I love to unpack, yeah.
What I learned eventually was when you go into the corporate world, I like to think of it as being like a tribe. And I think of it as an indigenous tribe. And when you think of an indigenous tribe and you think of what would be the rules if we were living in the Amazon or we were living in the savannas of Africa as an indigenous tribe, there's going to be some tribe rules. And so one of the first things is you don't do anything to embarrass yourself in front of the tribe because you don't want to be thrown out of the tribe because the hyenas and lions will eat you. Well, I didn't understand those rules particularly well. And what I would do is if it was something I could accomplish, I'd go do it. And of course, with us neurodiverse people, that tends to be great. If I can come in and solve the problem, you're going to say, great, cool. Let's sit down together and show me how you did it too. Well, unfortunately, in the tribal thing, it tends to happen that if you manage to accomplish things that the person above you was supposed to get done, but they didn't, that doesn't reflect good on you necessarily. In many situations.
So what I love what Tim's talking about. Okay, so I'll just summarize what we've heard so far because there's so much richness into what you shared. So in Tim's journey, a number of jobs, highly successful, but kept picking up on this disconnect, right? And then finally his wife is like, okay, got to figure out what's happening here. And then gets these diagnoses and realizes, oh my gosh, I need to update my mental model of the world. Like here I was just doing my best to be successful, pursuing my areas of passion, getting rewarded by being successful, but something's just been off. And wow, I need to update my mental model. And this idea of a tribal metaphor really helped Tim. And when it comes to where neurodiversity plays a role, I like how you construe it in that sense of neurodiversity is an invitation to rethink our mental model of how we connect with each other as people. And sometimes those of us where it's not intuitive for how to engage, we sometimes need a more granular mental model than others because we may inadvertently transgress social norms that are intuitive for the neurotypical side. And then for those of us who just don't always pick up on the cues, we're just like, okay, I'm lost here. But a mental model like that tribal idea is helpful. So being diagnosed gave Tim a reason to rethink his mental model and update it, just like a new software update. Look at me bringing in computers. Yay! I finally got on Sierra on my Mac. I was late to the party. how I feel interpersonally. But that's cool. So if you were to summarize it in a nutshell, if somebody handed you a mic and said, I'm here with Tim Goldstein. Tim Goldstein, how would you define neurodiversity? What would you say?
Well, the way I would explain neurodiversity would be, first off, the human brain is the most complex organ that we have in our body. And we completely accept that, you know, organs that are far simpler are, you know, we can have differences. We can have difference in skin color. We can have difference in our hair. We can have difference in our eye colors. And we accept that as being normal. But we don't even think that, you know, maybe my brain is wired and put together a little differently than Carrie's brain versus, you know, Patricia's brain versus, you know, Cornell's brain. We don't think of that, which doesn't make any sense when you think of it as being the most complex organ in our body. Further, the way that your brain is shaped and wired is going to a certain extent, dictate your kind of base method of perceiving and processing the world.
Your mental model, if you will.
Exactly. I mean, how you see the world is going to be shaped by, you know, the way your brain works and processes. Now, we're not geese, which means we can go, you know, north in the winter if we think that the hotel's nicer up north. You know, we're humans. We can learn to do different things. But even though you can learn to act different ways in different situations, what happens when the pressure gets cranked out on all of us?
Can I build my story
into
that segue?
Yeah.
Okay, speaking of pressure. So I was in theoretical physics doing my doctorate at Imperial College in London. Loved it, but then, this is going to date me, the Iraq War started, the dollar dropped, and funding became an issue. So I came back stateside to be like, okay, what do I do? Do I want to take out loans to finish? Like, this is, wait till the war ends. Anyway, landed in my first job where I was paid to think for a living. And it was so different because in the academic environment, it's designed for thinking. And then your corporate America in the early 2000s, it was not designed for thinking. And I was fascinated because I was like Sheldon. You know, apparently bosses don't like being told that their ideas are not logical and they actually violate some behavior science proven research-based practices, and I learned the hard way. So I was like, if I'm going to survive, I need to actually get paid to learn how to people. And so I went into human resource development, took a ton of classes, and learned by teaching the actual content itself of, like, teaching soft skills. And I never figured out why I didn't fit. At this point, I knew I had ADD, but I didn't know the autistic piece until fast forward to 2 years ago. I got a job in biopharma. I was a learning and development manager, and I was with like brainiacs who I loved because it felt like being back in academia, but also normal corporate folks. And this is Midwest Ohio, so this is like old school corporate. And I didn't realize that I had developed two personas. There was the dumbed down Carrie who was just like, I wouldn't ask any hard questions. I was just here to fit in. But then there was like the game on, challenge accepted Carrie who was just like, no, blah, 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 blah. And I had repressed the smart Carrie for so long that the nerds brought it out of me. So I was caught between two personas, the just tell it like it is, frank, smart Carrie, and then the HR so that my colleagues wouldn't be just mad at how I always bring up questions and issues. And I got called out by my Portuguese colleague because I love my Portuguese friends. They just call it everything on the carpet. She's just like, Caddy, I love you too much. I have to tell you this. And she was just like, why do you have two personas? And she was just like, on and on. And it was like, I love Liz and Nora for that because I cried, of course. I was like, you're right. And I went to my therapist. But I got to self-examine that there's two parts of me. And I shared to my therapist what goes on in my head. She said, have you been tested for autism? Because I said that I don't know how to read, like, at social situations feel like I'm walking into a room and I'm hitting my stride if it's a familiar situation, but as soon as something's different, it's like the lights are turned out, the furniture rearranged, but I have to keep walking as though I'm okay with it blindly. And I'm like, it's just like I have these lights out moments. So I got diagnosed, and as I shared in the earlier session, that I had so many awkward encounters with my boss. By that point, she was trying to get rid of me, that like slow managing out. And I was like, okay, I just need to quit and figure out who I am and how I can help this, you know, movement bring awareness to fellow nerds like me who mean well, but we come across wrong. So I started a consultancy and leaning into the agile space, which I love because there's a lot of neurodiverse agile movement, especially in England, which has been really cool. And so it brings me here. And so to your point about pressure, like that was my breaking point when I couldn't be two people anymore, right? I couldn't be the corporate persona that made everybody happy. But then the real Carrie was just like being a can of Coke shaken up of like coming out inadvertently. And then you're like, oh, sorry, I was being myself there for a minute. My apologies. Just disregard that. So it's neurodiversity for me is really the destigmatization of thinking different and assuming positive intent that just because I look like you, I don't think like you, right? And so it's looking for those win-win ways of working together. How can you leverage my superpowers and how can we leverage yours? Just like fusion cooking, you know, where it's like a tikka masala taco. It's not putting a tikka masala and a taco in a blender to where you have no unique cultural identities of either remaining. It's just this gross sludge. You have the, you know, integrity of the taco piece and you know where that originates and the tikka masala piece, and you know where that originates and you enjoy the combination of it and how it comes together uniquely. And that's what I see as awesome team cultures. So that's kind of my neat. And that's what you'll see. The more you meet of folks like us, we'll have different spins on neurodiversity, but really that destigmatizing of thinking different and making it safe to be you without judgment, assuming positive intent. And like updating your mental model to really build off what Tim was saying. Does that make sense how it kind of what we're saying fits?
You know, I think you hit on something really interesting
yeah,
there.
And then we'll transition to this, yeah. But yeah.
You know, kind of in my model, I use this model I refer to as the neurocloud. And the neurocloud is based on that idea that, you know, the way your brain is shaped and wired is going to kind of dictate how you are. So if you just imagine that you've got this whole big cloud that's full of like pieces of glitter and confetti just kind of flipping around, and each piece represents a different way a human perceives and processes. And if we were to go and put a grouping around it, I mean, we're data science kind of people, so, you know, we're going to go run some algorithm and group them somehow. We're going to end up with one large group, and that group is going to get called neurotypical. Nothing special about it other than it's the majority. That's it. I mean, it's not that neurotypical is better, it's worse. It's just that there's more of them around. You know, I like to say
the
if you were to
Gaussian
throw,
curve where it's the majority.
Yeah, I like to say if you throw all humans in a bag and were to grab one, you're most likely going to pull out a neurotypical. That's the majority of humans. The interesting thing is when you're talking neurodiversity, neurotypical is not different from being neurodiverse. Neurodiversity is this concept that involves both neurotypical thoughts and our different kind of thoughts.
And if you have Asperger attributes, I say you have a touch of ass. What? Get it? wordplay.
But I think what I like about the neurocloud concept, which is another one of the concepts I went and created because the ones that were out there in the autism world didn't work for me. The concept that you go from low functioning to high functioning. What the hell does that mean? Does high functioning mean that I can go out and get, you know, really great jobs? Or does high functioning mean that, is it low functioning because I get fired from great jobs? I don't know. It's kind of hard to understand that kind of term.
We'll have Pam answer that later.
Yeah, exactly. that's why I like much more this idea of the neurocloud, mm-hmm. because you have this mixing going on. Yes, you can have primarily some of the thought processes of somebody who is neurodiverse. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have some of the ADA, you know, ADD kind of tendencies where everything grabs your attention. Or maybe you have the autistic kind of tendencies where we do, where we just want to like, go after every detail like it's, you know, the most important thing in the world. But that's not, you know, that doesn't make us any different than you can take a neurotypical and you can come up with the same things. There are certain traits they tend to have that are similar. They tend to be emotionally involved, I guess that's probably the best term, is most neurotypicals have a strong connection to emotion and emotional feeling, and that's a lot of their world. In the autism world, well, I'll ask you, how much is emotion in your day-to-day part of your world?
Oh, it's a lot. It has to do with the unique connectivity between your logic and emotion brain. It's where we can only filter either we're with you on the concrete data points of what you're saying logically, and then we deal with the emotion later.
Yeah.
Or we're just fully present for the emotion and we hear nothing that you say, but it's really hard to get both at once. And so you'll see a lot of weird expressions on our faces if you come at us. Dave, I'm always picking on you. He was in the front row before. But if you're just like, Carrie, I have to make a choice, which is like, am I going to pay attention to the actual word choices he's making? Or am I going to get distracted by all this emotion and try to figure out how he's feeling? It's hard to do both at once, but that could just be, and this is a rabbit trail that will not go down, but women who are of autism versus men, because as a female Aspie, there's a lot of emotion. We just can't process it all at once. But for guys, it's different, which is crazy.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say in the NeuroCloud, and that's another thing that I like about the model versus that low to high function model that comes from the medical world is, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Autism for females expresses very differently than autism for males. And I've talked to quite a number of, you know, Asperger females, including yourself, and the response is always very similar, that you can sense the emotion going on in the room, you can sense the change.
We can see the shifts in the behaviors, but
we don't know what to do about it.
And we don't know what it means.
Right.
It's just like saying, okay, I can see there's a lot happening here, but I'm not sure how to translate it.
Whereas for a guy, most guys that are in the autism spectrum, we don't even pick up on those emotional shifts that they even happened.
Yes.
If we're like explaining something, we're going for it and we're explaining something and that you tuned out and, you know, have nothing to listen anymore, we totally missed it. We don't even know that you're not in the room anymore. You could get up and leave. We'd probably keep talking.
So what I love, Tim, is we're starting to dive into the actual questions because you're hitting on some key topics with how to relate to folks. So if it's okay with you,
we're just having fun here.
Yeah, so what I love is so far we did our introduction, so you know a little bit about our stories. We defined neurodiversity, which as you can see, it's really a similar. Tim has his mental model of it. I have my definition of just destigmatizing differences, but they complement each other. Ask somebody who has autism what their definition is. It'll be complementary but different because we're all very individual beings. As Tim was saying, you meet one person with autism, you only met one person with autism.
But same thing, you meet one neurotypical, you've only met one neurotypical.
Exactly.
You know, not everybody's the same.
Yes. So we don't want to like bring that stigmatization of like, you know,
yeah, right. That neurotypicals are all, they're just all emotional.
Right.
And that's the only way they are. No, they vary all over the spectrum too. Of some aren't emotional, some are hugely emotional.
So when it comes to the questions that we heard, there was three major categories, as I mentioned, the first being relating. How do you relate to people on the spectrum? So if it's okay with you guys, I'll read a question, let Tim respond, and then I'll build on it. And we'll kind of make it through some of the questions that we heard from you guys and then take some live Q&A, if that sounds good. Does that work for you?
It works for me.
Okay. So Tim, I like this question with under the relating category. How do you can you identify when somebody is struggling because they think different versus for different reasons?
I like to say that, you know, if you're a manager, there's one job that you should be doing, and unfortunately, nobody teaches it in management school.
Ooh.
And the one job that a manager's number one primary job they should be doing is managing the stress of their employees, period. If they were to do that, everything in their group would go better.
But how does that help people understand?
Now, where that falls in is, I fully believe that most neurodiverse people essentially are your canaries in the coal mine. If there's going to be a problem due to stress, due to rapid change, due to whatever, you're going to see it first with your neurodiverse people. Not that it's not affecting your neurotypicals, they're just better at covering it up. You're not going to notice it because they have better abilities at handling their own emotions and keeping them, you know, within constraints. Your neurodiverse people, we tend to kind of go, you know, as Patricia would know, kind of go, blah, and you just get it all dumped all over you. And there's no meaning or intent of, you know, negativity. It's just, this is what's going on in my brain. And if I don't explain it to you, I'm going to blow up because you need to understand this.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you correctly, if somebody's struggling because they think different, one thing that you've seen manifest is those of us who think different are more prone to get easily stressed in specific situations, and we're more prone to come to you and just start talking at you, and we want you to be empathetic and ask us questions?
No, we really don't want you to be empathetic and ask us questions because the empathy, I don't know. Okay. It's nice, but it's one of those feelings.
How do you want Patricia to respond then?
To me, you know.
No empathy for Tim, guys. No empathy. He doesn't need. I'm just kidding.
No, that's fine.
I think I'm teasing.
To me, one of the most important things you can do when you're dealing with any human. This isn't just a neurodiverse human. This is any human. Because I like to say, these aren't medical traits we're talking about. Just because she and I are talking about having extreme levels of particular traits, mm-hmm. we can go find other people who everybody would agree is neurotypical, but might show that one trait. So we're really just talking about ranges of human traits, and we just happen to have a few piled up, but they're still human traits. The first thing I say is, never deny somebody's reality. Their reality is their reality. I mean, you may not agree with it, you may not like it, but nonetheless, their reality is their reality. So you have to acknowledge at least that to them, that is the truth and that is reality. So that's my first thing is never deny somebody's reality because particularly with somebody on the spectrum, you're probably going to get a negative reaction from it.
Can I build on that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So and so that is a way that I like to approach when like coaching people who've got like autistic employees, and the way I identify when they're struggling and they need that type of intervention is when they consistently violate interpersonal protocol and appear absolutely clueless, almost to a childlike degree, or they get so like dog to a bone about their perspective that it's just like, it's not normal. And so I'm like, I now see it as, oh, you're one of us. I love it. And because what that clues you into when you see that level of intensity is to then shift from a cognitive mindset of let me read into this behavior and think of what could have elicited these emotional responses and the motive behind it. No. Throw away all that Freudian psychology. Put your behaviorist hat on and be like, okay, it's time for renegotiating new behaviors. And so it's just saying, okay, so there was a situation yesterday. This behavior happened. This was the impact. Let's find a different way to behave in this situation and treat it very clinical, like an actual negotiation, because it's not personal. Behaviors, when you're on the spectrum, they're just strategies for getting your needs met. And we want better strategies. And so to renegotiate it in a more clinical way rather than emotional is super helpful. So if you see folks just violating social norms and not getting it, that's a big clue that they're thinking different. And I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, I would say just kind of, you know, tagging on that, because we have a tendency to not process emotions as well. And like you say, you notice them more than I notice them, which probably puts you in a worse case because you know something's going on that I don't, but we don't know what to do about them. We don't know how to really deal with them. So I think what essentially happens is those emotions are still going on in our body. I mean, the chemicals are being put out that cause, you know, the different feelings that neurotypicals would process into being information as emotions. Behind what we're thinking, so while we're living in a logical world, we are biological beings and our body is saying, go kill, or, you know, I'm outraged, or I'm like upset, or I'm frustrated, or I'm stuck, but we don't process that in our brain of coming to you and saying, you know, I'm just really frustrated over this situation. The way we process it in our brain is, I don't know what the hell to do.
So then how do you behave? And then we'll open up for questions about this particular one. So how does that react? How does that manifest in behavior when you're feeling that way?
Well, for me, it tends to push me towards violating social norms.
Okay.
Because I get so, as you said, you get so worked up and wrapped up on that idea that... And it's not that you want to violate social norms. I like to say all the time, it's not that I don't care about your feelings. I do care about all of you. The difference is, I don't even think about your feelings when I'm talking. It just never even comes into my mind that your feelings are something I'm supposed to think about while I'm trying to tell you things. So it's not that I have a wanton desire to go out and, you know, be rude and nasty to people, but any of us, if you put us under enough pressure, I mean, we'll take Cornell, about the most balanced guy I know.
Let's ask, we'll open it for questions.
But, you know, crank him under enough pressure and we're going to see, you know, less than the normal Cornell we see. And that's true of all of us.
So what questions do you guys have? Because I really like that question. How do you identify when somebody else is struggling because they think different? In other words, how do you start identifying us nerds in the wild? Ask us questions. Yeah.
I actually have a question about, like, for me personally, I know I have a really big issue when people think they're identifying a problem with me that's stemming from my neurodiversity, and it's not. It's like, no, this isn't me being sensitive because I'm depressed. This is me being an asshole. Not you. Sorry.
No. That fits plenty of times. Trust me. So it's okay. You know.
So that is something that it affects me. I worry about doing to other people is, you know, seeing the stress and thinking, oh, it's because this is happening to them.
This is the way I like to kind of think about that is. The problem a lot of people have in understanding neurodiversity is, I think as humans, we all approach things this way, which is, we only know one human experience, and that's the one we've all lived. And each one of us has lived a different human experience. So whenever you're going to relate to somebody, I mean, you have to start from somewhere, so you're probably going to start with, they're like me, and then you're going to go, but, and then you're going to start putting in, you know, the changes. I mean, if it was the two of you to come together, you go, he's kind of like me, but he's male, and you're going to go, oh, but she's female. Okay, and then we're going to start fleshing out some differences till you get, you know, where you can have a relationship going on. The problem with starting with like me, but.
Is that part of your question that you were asking?
Which is really what they're doing, is they're saying like me, but, and they're thinking, well, if I acted like Carrie's acting like now for me, that would mean X, which is why I say you can't start with like me, but. I explain it as, if you're going to deal with people who are neurodiverse, think that you're talking to a group of aliens, period. You don't know anything about them. You have to define everything you're going to do between them because there's very little you share in common. And that gets you over the, oh, like me, but. Let's start out with not like me at all. Now tell me who you really are.
I wonder, because one of the things that I was taught in my counseling classes was about asking questions, right? Never leading with, like, here's what I'm thinking, but, like, with questions. And so in that case, if there was certain behavior that you were exhibiting, instead of coming in with a, here's what I think is the problem, it's
right.
Here are the facts of what I'm noticing, what I'm just seeing, what is coming up for you. And then that gives the person the opportunity, the one to feel validated of something's coming up for me,
right.
And I get to tell you this. To me, it's about power, right? I have the power to tell you what's coming up for me versus you prescribing.
See, and I don't think it's power. I agree with you 1,000,000%. You're dead on. The only thing is, I don't think it's power for me, at least, and it'll be interesting to see what you say. It's being misunderstood my entire life, and feeling like this is just another experience of not being understood. There's no power feeling to it to me. I guess I would say I'm relatively power neutral. I don't care if it's the global office or whoever that I'm already trading emails who's pissed off at me, or whether it's, you know, just another one of my coworkers. It doesn't matter. I don't feel one has more power. They're all humans, period.
And a neat area of cultural intelligence. Have you guys heard of that exciting area? Yeah, so cultural intelligence is like an elevated version of emotional intelligence, where it actually gives you that mindset that I hear in what you're reflecting on, which is come to the table with no preconceived notions and just be very open to saying, okay, I'm going to let the situation, the people, and the moment inform me with the data I need instead of bringing my own to the table, and then building off of that. Improv is just like an improv. You're just like, you let you and your scene partner discover the scene together instead of bringing your baggage.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's it. I mean, just don't go and start with, oh, if I did that, this is what it would mean. Start with, I think Cornell has the perfect answer. Hey, I noticed that look like you're struggling a little bit, or I look like, you know, you look like you're a little stressed today, or whatever it is.
Yes, curious thought partner.
What's going on? Is there anything I can help you with?
I noticed this behavior.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And like,
so that's just fact, right?
Yeah.
Here's what I saw.
Right.
What's coming up?
And then you're giving the open, you know, the honest, open, and comfortable space of saying, hey, I noticed something seems a little off with you. Tell me, man, can I help you in some way?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
huge.
If everybody did that, we'd have a whole lot less problems in most of corporate America.
But let's listen to what our friends in New York office have to say. Do you guys have any questions or comments when it comes to identifying when somebody is struggling because they think different? And how, what, any questions for us or even strategies that you're looking into employing that you want to talk about?
I mean, I have a question. So we talked a lot about like approaching people when you notice that they're struggling, and let's say you do the COI method and you discuss the behavior. And I know this would probably vary on an individual basis, but are there special considerations for how neurodiverse people process information or criticism after the fact?
You mean like how to circle back after you've had that conversation, or how do you position the information in order to make sure that the processing that does happen results in the objective you're trying to achieve?
The latter, yeah.
Oh, for so setting the interaction up for long-term success.
Yeah, and then like is that another, like, is that a potential sore point or difficult point for people who are neurodiverse talking about Asperger's or things that we were discussing today?
I would say that yes, you definitely have hit upon an area where there can be challenges. And the challenge really is no different than the challenge that two neurotypicals have dealing with each other. It's just more extreme, that's all. And what the challenge is that you do something that is going to degradate the relationship. That's the real challenge, is how do you work through it without making the other person feel minimized and less than? I mean, if you come at it with, oh, Carrie, it's your autism that's causing this problem. Well, what did I just do to her? I mean, I just said, there's something wrong with you. You've got to, like, you know, that isn't a very good way to start a relationship with each other. So I think that's the thing, is just, you just think about it like dealing with anybody else, except remember that you're dealing with a group of people that in general live on the logic side of their brains, and they don't live in the emotion side of their brains. So if you come at them with an emotional thing, we're going to sit there with it spinning in our head, not having a clue where to put it or where to go with it.
And then I'll build on Tim's answer, and then I'll add some complimentary points that could answer your question. So when it comes to setting up the conversation for success, what I love about studying teams is, and especially teams with like, I like artists and geeks and like other people who think different, is similar to improv coaches setting up the tone for their class. And this is what they do. It's very interesting, but this is what I love bringing into each conversation and interaction, is you set a base reality. You inadvertently or overtly state kind of the ground rules of the interaction. You set the tone, in other words, and you're very intentional about the tone you set. And when you set, for instance, when I'm going to be taking over a team to lead, I let people know, like, hey, by the way, sometimes I get really excited and get carried away. So if I start going off on something, just like do the little soapbox or awkward turtle, like, just let me know, you know, and we kind of have this chance to talk as a team and to create some little ground rules so that we can then, when we do have those conversations, have that mutual understanding. We got to humanize ahead of time, create some base reality ground rules so that we can be proactive and define how our dynamic's going to be, instead of just stumbling upon emotionally charged topics and just letting nature take its course. So was that kind of helpful? Did we somehow answer your question jointly? Or?
Yeah.
Yes, high five.
Cool.
So the next one I like is, not I like, I'm literally going in order, it's not me, like, I'm only going to cherry pick the ones that I like. No, but each one's great. So
we did the
me.
Cherry picking before we came down here.
Oh, stop it.
Well, it's true, though.
No, we didn't.
Oh, well, I did.
Tim. Now, it's this question, because it's from a neurodiverse person, which is why it was like, oh, one of us, is how can I better navigate my own neurodiversity? And I think it plays nicely on our conversation so far. So before we dive into that, does anybody want to add to that question? Who may be neurodiverse either in this room or in New York that wants to make...
Or maybe know somebody neurodiverse, or maybe has a significant other that is neurodiverse. It can fit in lots of ways.
Yeah. So when it comes to navigating neurodiversity, how can we focus this question?
I'm specifically ADHD.
Yes.
And I have a lot of problems with either not being able to focus on something if I'm not, like, if it doesn't grab me, then I just kind of like let it sit on my computer for half of the day.
Yes.
And then don't do anything with it. And like just kind of check Slack and look at it and go like, and I'm like, go back and check Slack. Or I have the opposite problem where I'm really into it and I just dive in. I put in headphones and like I've literally had moments where teammates have had to come over and like have started dancing next to me because I was just like sitting there like typing up, doing whatever, and we had a team meeting and they would like dance and like do a bunch of crazy things and then like eventually have to come over and like tap me on the shoulder and just be like, hey, get out of the zone. I'm like, I'm wondering how I can better navigate that and like problems like that, because I have I've noticed that increasing as I've worked here.
Well, one thing that's interesting is I read an article this morning that was talking about neurodiversity, and it was just in Geek News, basic stuff. It's a /.org. So I don't know if any of you are /.org readers, but it's about as geeky as the news can get. And they had an article about neurodiversity talking about the prevalence of ADD or ADHD and dyslexia, of being 1 in 10 for either one of those, as opposed to autism, which is what, you know, Carrie and I share, which is 1 out of 59.
I got ADD too, so I'll be able to speak to that. I feel you.
But what it was really pointing out was, under the current diagnostic methods that were in place, so DSM-4 and earlier, you could not have ADD and be autistic simultaneously, according to DSM-4. If you were autistic, that precluded that you could be ADHD, vice versa. Now, we certainly know that they go together and there's comorbidities. So what's starting to happen is we're recognizing that a lot of the, and again, I keep going back to, these are human traits. These are not, you know, condition, issue, disease traits. They're just human traits. But we're recognizing that high levels of human traits that are involved with ADHD are the exact same ones that are involved with autism. The only difference being, with autism, you don't have necessarily the social understanding, whereas with ADHD, you have the social understanding, but with both of them, you have the lack of focus. If it doesn't interest you, you don't do it.
Yes. So for some practical tips, if you're interested, what I've seen, first of all, Pomodoros, do you do those? Pomodoros. Okay. So a lot of folks in the IT space that I've met, at least in my Midwestern world of agility, so I don't know about here, but you set the timer for 25 minutes. You do 25-minute sprints. 4 25-minute sprints where you take a 5-minute break after the 25 minutes. And then your fourth sprint is a 30-minute break. And it's short enough to where it's like it's easier to talk your brain into focusing on something you're not interested in. And it's all the developers I know use it and they love it for that reason. It's just kind of like if you're doing work you don't like. And then it's also so that's one way to arrange your environment. But then there's also the challenge of then what is it that you can learn from it, or what component of it can you leverage in something else you're interested in? So how can you bake your previous interests within it? I don't know if that's helpful because it's brain science.
I was going to say, there's a lot of different things. I mean, that's certainly one approach. It's good.
But this is, okay, brain science. I love it. Oh, so because it has to do with what your motivators are. So the intrinsic motivation is what keeps you in that state of flow, right? And that's what we love being in, is that place where we love creating and innovating, right? When we don't have that intrinsic motivation and we don't like what we're doing, we have to then create an environment where there's extrinsic motivators, things that we can reward ourselves externally. Like, I'm going to get a drink after work and I'm going to hang out with my friends. And you have to bribe yourself. Bribing yourself and finding ways to build in things you like are literally the ways that you can motivate yourself through those periods when it comes to how to manipulate your environment and to compel yourself to then shift your focus in something you're just not naturally interested in. It's the whole
motivation. Yeah, I'd say one other thing I would throw in is simply be open to other people about it. I mean, I know it's scary, it's hard at first of just being totally blunt and open with somebody. I don't know. What's it like, Patricia, having an employee just say to you, I'm autistic? And it's not, I imagine it feels a little uncomfortable at first. It's not what you're used to hearing, at least.
It wasn't what I used to hearing, but...
You did very well, by the way, just, you know.
Thanks. But I was super appreciative that you let me know up front and you gave me resources to say, hey, this is how I am, this is how to work with me, and I found that super helpful.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying that sometimes actually divulging can be helpful, but not if you just divulge and say, I have ADHD or ADD, and then you walk off. That doesn't do anything. As Patricia said, I gave her some materials and stuff to help her understand how to work with me better. So it was not only being upfront, but it was being upfront along with, here's how we can help build this bridge between us. But I think if you don't say it, then you're suffering on your own. That's the bottom line. People will be more than willing to help you if you're open about it.
And then how can you create that environment that makes doing what you need to get done as easy as possible, which could include making it as fun as possible, but by bribing yourself with chocolate or other things if it's not interesting enough. Because there's parts of our work that we all don't like. But that's where as a leader, you're like, okay, I may need to throw a pizza party to incentivize my team to finish this deliverable because none of us like this end of the quarter sales, whatever. So it's that balance. I hope we answered your questions. I know there was we're about up to, and you got two Aspies up here who just could talk all day.
Forever, you know.
You poor things. So thank you very much for letting us geek out with you. And hopefully that gave you some insight. If anything, you'll walk away and be like, wow, I'm glad I don't have that going on in my head.
And I would say to anybody from Looker that, this, I'm obviously a Looker. It's tim.goldstein@looker.com. Slack me, reach out to me, feel free. Judgment, I suffer with lots of stuff myself,
You have a friend in Tim.
Yeah, you got a friend.
Awesome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, New York.
We hope that you've enjoyed another episode of Life in a Neurotypical Universe. Please, if you enjoyed this, share it with your friends. Go take their phone and subscribe them. Heck, it will help us all out. If you want to know more about neurodiversity or have any questions for me, you can reach me at my website, timgoldstein.com, where I'll be more than glad to help you as best I can to navigate through the neurotypical universe.